Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast.
As we kick off season three of Open Trailer Podcast, this is stage number three of Dave Cudamarche. Last time out, we talked about the Super Modified days, how Dave might have been the last to know that Ralph Cusack, his driver, was hanging up the helmet, at least on a full-time basis. We actually heard about Ralph's brief comeback in that episode and some other cool tidbits from his career at Beech Ridge Motor Speedway, where he is a Hall of Famer. He's also a Maine State Hall of Famer. And this time out, we get into the end of the Modifieds at Beech Ridge and what really went down there. What you might not have known is that Dave was part of what didn't turn out to be a solution to the Modified issue, not necessarily just to Beech Ridge, but Modifieds in general, circa 1989, 1990. Dave meets a very young Mike McLaughlin and talks about whether or not running what is known now as the Whelen Modified Tour was a viable option for his team. Oh yeah, by the way, they went to New Hampshire and won a championship and ran up front there too. Some pretty amazing stories, lots of ground to cover. Thank you for your support of this podcast. You can do so by making a one-time donation or becoming a monthly Patreon contributor to patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast. If you contribute monthly, you'll be part of an exclusive crew that gets early access to these episodes. We drop them a few days in advance of Open Trailer Thursday, which is traditional drop day. We'll also hook you up with some Open Trailer Podcast merch, which, I mean, honestly, is just a sticker. But, it's something. And all of the money raised goes to research, funding of equipment, and travel expenses, whatnot. And to give you an idea, I mean, just to keep these episodes alive, it's over $100 a year. So, I mean, not much, but your contributions allow that to continue to happen. So thank you. Let's get to it. Stage number three of Open Trailer Podcast with Dave Cudamarche. So you take some of the 87 year off. You're attending to business and family stuff. Yes. You come back in 88 with a different driver.
Yeah. David Pinkham pitted right close to us. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I knew Alan Berry, his crew chief and stuff.
They had just come off the Wildcat, the Limited Sportsman Championship.
He had won the Limited Sportsman Championship in his own, in their number 89 car. Mm-hmm. And stuff. And he was dating my daughter, Gretchen. Mm-hmm. At the time, so there was a heavy promotion there.
By who?
Someone in my family, by David. And, yeah. And Alan said he'd come over and help us, you know, if that happened. So, yeah, the car needed a new snout. I sent it down to Eddie St. Angelo. He originally built that car. And he put a new snout on it, so it came back as like.
Was this the same car that you raced on dirt in 85?
Yep, it was the same car.
Can you tell me about the transition between the Pinto body and the Cavalier body, which is primarily what modifieds look like today, the modern day look of a open wheel car?
Yeah, the Pinto was a whole stock body. We used to get them from the junkyard. You know, I had. Well, that was a sponsor that never gave me any money. I should mention his name is Morris Auto Parts in Auburn there, you know, because I could get, if I needed a power steering pump, we used to just use automotive pumps for years or rack and pinion, you know, or another Pinto body. Mm-hmm. You know, he gave them to me. Don St. Germain's his name. And he also helped out Mike Rowe on the 5 there for years up to Oxford.
How come Mike never drove full time for you?
He was committed to Butch and... You know, and they were just doing so well up to Oxford, you know, and stuff. So we made a few out-of-state trips, you know, with Mike and stuff, but they were few and far between.
Do you guys go to Connecticut?
We did. After the Super Modifieds ended in the start of the 79 season, I had the engine from the Super Modified, and I didn't know if it would run cool or not on gasoline, but we because it had so much compression.
Right, right, right.
And that's before NASCAR came out with the 12-to-1 rule for the tour motors. And it was also the year that offset chassis were legal, okay?
What does that mean?
You could have, I think they started with maybe a 6-inch offset. The left frame rail could be over. They, you know, could carry more left side weight because my Pinto race guy was straight up. The engine was in the center and, you know. Mm. And so we decided we're going to go to the icebreaker at Thompson. Mike had never driven there before and stuff. And that, of course, with that Supermarket, he did have, that motor had a lot of power. Mm. And we ended up fifth the first time we ever went there in the icebreaker. It was like 60 cars there. And so we says, geez, we're doing good there. We'll go to the Spring Sizzler, Stafford. So we went over to the Sizzler. There was 103 cars in the pits. And Mike qualified for the Spring Sizzler that year. We ended up dropping a valve seat out of that engine. And so it was skipping towards the end. I think we finished like 17th or something. But
Yeah, to bring it back a little bit, you know, talking about Mike and Larry Tangway, you know, had that success in year 61. Wasn't there a driver exchange program with England
that
Larry
was
a part of?
Yep.
How did you play into that?
Well, Larry won the feature that qualified you to go to England. Mm. And I didn't know if he'd go or not because he was leading in the points at that time. And he'd won the last feature before he would go over there and stuff. And in exchange, I would get a guy named Frankie Wayman. I believe I said that right. Wayman. Mm-hmm. That would come back when Larry was done and drive my spare car. That was the deal. So Larry wanted to go. So that weekend, it was a double race weekend. He was gone. I think it was Labor Day weekend. So I had to come up with two drivers to replace Larry while he was in England. So I talked Ralph into driving one night to come back.
And this is 1982?
83.
So his final race wasn't, I mean, aside
his
from Ride Your Life.
His last full season was 1980. But he came,
did come back.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's about 10 laps to go. He's still on the back end of the feature. All of a sudden, I see him dusting the high groove off. Then if he didn't drive that thing all the way to second, I think he could have won. I think he laughed. He didn't want to win it because it wouldn't have looked good, you know, with
track owner.
The track owner winning the feature.
Wow.
And so the other night I got Mike to come down and drive it, and he finished third with it. So
how'd that other guy do, English guy?
He came over, and he was very good with my stuff. Yeah. You know, he didn't crash either night. He said the cars were a lot faster than their cars over there. Even though their cars over there had big block engines in them and everything, it was a different kind of race. And they
raced on asphalt out there, right?
It was dirt in England.
Oh, okay.
It was dirt, yeah. And Larry Tangway's telling me there's this big cable around the whole racetrack, right? It's really strong cable. And all those cars got a post on them. So if they get sent into the wall, the post on the right front of your car hits that cable and kind of bounces you back into the... the whole affair.
That seems dangerous.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that was, you know, to say that you had somebody come from England and drive your
car. I think you're one of the few, you know, in Maine that's had that happen.
And then he says, after the races was over the second night, he says, there's one other thing I want to do. And I says, what's that? He says, I want to drive your bus. He says, you mean onto the front stretch? Well, he says, if that's as far as you let me take it.
Yeah.
Because we were hauling on a trailer and back too with it.
Wow. How, you have a name for that bus?
I never did. But I always wondered if that wasn't the thought that started the bus at Beechridge, you know, because that got painted orange too with the kiddie bus, the kiddie ride bus. That might have started that.
Wow. So let's go back to not the current, but, you know, if we're talking about racing in a chronological order. So young David Pinkham gets behind the wheel of your car in 1988, and you guys have instant success.
It was amazing. You know, David, by trade, was a heavy equipment operator, you know, and he had tremendous eye-hand control stuff. And he was smooth. He was smooth like Ralph was. I was just amazed. and he could stay out of trouble. And that first year, as a rookie in the modifieds, he won the track championship. I mean,
were you worried about someone coming from the limited sportsman division, which traditionally is your entry level class, three wide racing, 35, 40 cars per event. So, you know, kind of used to leaning on people that you can't do in a modified.
Yeah, exactly. I certainly was worried about it, but I knew right away he had that knack for staying out of trouble.
Yeah.
And I think he won two features that year in the championship. And
then you back it up again.
And then he backed it up the second year. Yeah, yeah, he did.
So you're still sponsored by Coors,
yes,
at this point.
Yep.
And, we've already established that nobody's stepping out of line on this one. You've been able to keep it going pretty well. But unfortunately, there's some worry that's coming down right around that area of time that the modifieds are not going to be part of the weekly program at Beechridge anymore. Do you remember when you got that news?
Well, it was 1990, of course, and we'd had the driver that died on the front stretch wall in a modified. You know, and then Lou Weatherby got hurt real bad bouncing off the front stretch wall and stuff. And I think that was Ralph and Jane, I just think, were so worried.
Yeah, and you know,
it was supposed to be a family track, you know what I mean? And the modifieds everywhere, you know, we just lost a whole bunch of modified drivers. And we all made the mistake of making the front clip so sturdy that when it hit something, all you did was had to put some steering pads back on the right front, but the frame was all right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the driver took all of that pressure.
We lost Charlie J, Richie Evans, of course.
Tony Jankowiak, and down to Stafford. And the first of it was Freddie DeSaro at Thompson. He went down over the sandbank there. And Corky Cookman.
That was the guy I was thinking of, yeah. So, I mean, it was a real scary time for open wheel racing, and obviously it's thriving today. Do you get to watch any of the, whether it's Modified Racing Series, the JDV Modifieds, or the Whelen Modified Tour? Do you watch any of that as a spectator today?
The last couple of years since the COVID thing, I stayed in Florida during the COVID thing, you know, and so I missed out on quite a bit of it. I go to New Smyrna, you know, for the Modifieds. When they're there for speed weeks. And for a long time after I got done my own cars, I could just kind of chase the races. That was kind of my hobby, you know. I loved going to new racetracks I'd never been to. And the modifieds were my favorite car, you know.
I think it's a way of life, you know. And I bring that context present day because I think we had a lot of younger listeners to the podcast, and they didn't live that time of the late 80s, where it was very scary to be a modified competitor.
Yes.
And the context of, well, why did, you know, Beechridge get rid of the modifieds? Well, there, you know, the climate of that time was such a scary thing as well. And I think that certainly had something to do with it. But what was it like to, you know, to get that news that all of the investment that you had made as a team owner and the thousands of dollars that you had tied up, how much time did you have between the announcement and the last race?
Well, there were some. It was enough because Ralph had given us a few weeks off there, and we went over to Claremont to race maybe 3 or 4 weeks, you know, while after those incidents had happened. And he brought us back and he put...
So they pulled the modifieds for a few weeks.
Yeah, and he put restrictor plates on them when we come back. And you couldn't pass if you started up. Whoever started up front won the feature. You just... It just killed them there, you know. It was a great idea, but it wasn't going to work. And I had several conversations about Ralph, maybe what we could do. And probably not many know, but David and I actually went over there and tested with late model tires on the car to run the same tires that they ran. And it would have been cheaper for us, but everybody had to buy new wheels and all this and that. You know, because Ralph was digging to try to find, he loved the modifieds too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says, we'll move the fuel cell into the center of the car, not have it offset, maybe take some left side weight off and everything. Well, Dan, when we did that tire test, we tested with new modified tires, then we tested with new late model tires. It was during the week. And we went just as fast with the late model tires on that. Now, whether we would have over a long run, over 30, 35 laps, would they have fallen off? They were actually a little quicker to begin with because they heated up quicker. You know, like at the start of a race, that was great. You could just go.
Right.
You know, where the modified tire is 15 inches wide, it took a little while to get some heat into them.
Why didn't you guys run a full tire cycle that day?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Who
we
knows?
Didn't. We didn't. We probably, I don't even remember what it was, 12, 15.
You put
laps.
It out there for a few laps. You're like, well, it's probably going to be what it is.
And it was so close to, I mean, the times were just so close that it wasn't going to accomplish what he was after to find a real reason to keep the modifieds there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and for me, I had two complete modifieds at that time. Alan had built Alan Barry had built a brand new car for the 1990 season. And it was, we put some ideas into the front clip like my old Pinto had had. And that worked really good for us and stuff. So we had two really good cars. And I think if I'd have said to Sandy at that time, you know, we'd been through all our super modified stuff got junked because the super modifieds I had weren't any good to race at Star or Oswego or anything. They were heavy cars, you know, compared to what would have been there. So I ate all that stuff. And just 5 years, you know, just a few years later, I got to make another, you know.
So it's three big race cars.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we couldn't have done it. It would just, it would have been ridiculous for us to do that. So that's when we started racing at Monadnock on Fridays and Claremont Saturday nights.
And where's your team based out of at this point?
Saco.
So you went from Saco, I mean, where this podcast is being recorded, to Monadnock, which, you know, that's 2.5, 3 hours. I mean, with 3 hours with a trailer, I'm sure.
It was 3 hours most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's before 101 was all redone.
And I couldn't take off from work when the car left. Alan and David used to take the car. Alan was working for Bill Griffin at the time. Bill would give him, he'd let him out at noontime, and they'd head to Monadnock on Fridays. And,
you know, you speak highly of Alan. Alan, who still prepares cars today, has his business. Can you tell me a little bit about Alan Barry's level of intelligence when it comes to setting up a race car and building them?
Well, Alan is just a tremendous fabricator. I mean, I just stopped welding when Alan joined the crew. You know, it was like, I'm not even in his league.
Yeah.
You know, and when he was starting his own business there and stuff, I just gave him what I had I had a wire feed welding machine and stuff. And I just let him have it. And but yeah, he's built a lot of race cars for people in this area.
Yeah.
And I believe he built Sally Girardi's cars. Well, 3 years?
About 20 years ago, you know, you mentioned the welding thing. Funny thing about Alan is that, I don't have a mechanical background, but I will always remember something that Alan told me when he was showing me how he welds cars, and it always stuck with me. I don't want to give away a secret, but he has a certain way that he welds cars that seems to make them handle and go fast. And I don't know, again, like, how does someone know how to milk a cow? Right? Who's the first person to figure that out, and how do they figure that out? How did he figure out the weld?
You know, way back, that last car I built for Oxford, if I could go back to there for the 1970 season, they had some pretty strict rules on you couldn't cut springs and, you know, you couldn't just do anything you wanted there on the chassis. So I don't know whether somebody else was doing it, or I thought of it myself. I put it on my frame machine, and I twisted the frame first to put some cross weight into the frame. And while I was on the frame machine, I put the cage on it, and that car really went really well. You know, it was a stock automotive frame back then,
Yeah, smart guy. So you go to New Hampshire, where you're, I wouldn't say completely out of your element. That's, you know, beginning a modified country over there. But you're the team from Maine trying to make it happen over there. How does that go over there?
Well, first, Riverside Park was still in existence at that time. So Monadnock on Friday nights, where some of the cars from Riverside Park came up to race with the cars that came down from Claremont to race there on Saturday night. And at that time we were over there, Jerry Marquis was kind of the person to beat over there. And on the Claremont, from Riverside Park, and from the Claremont side, it was Dwight Jarvis, you know, and a bunch of others. Because that was a tough field of cars. I mean, you had to qualify. They had more cars than they started in the feature. I think they started 22 cars in the feature, quarter mile.
But you guys, you know, you do pretty well between Monadnock and Claremont.
We were in the, we raced over there for 4 years. We were in the top three in points at Claremont all the 4 years we were there.
David driving the car?
Yeah. And David won the track championship there in 1993.
Wow. You know, around this time, New Hampshire, what is now known as New Hampshire Motor Speedway, comes into play. I did see a few pictures of, because the Core sponsorship's no longer there.
The Core sponsorship stopped when Beechridge stopped, because they're a local distributor. And they were very good. They called the gentleman over in Concord, who headed in that area, the Coors distributorship, and he says, I'm helping Mike McLaughlin. You know, remember when Mike had the Coors guys and stuff?
Oh, yeah, that was unstoppable, that
and
extra gold.
He says, I can't do, you know, these guys are going all over the place. You know, he's getting a lot of exposure.
And your path had already crossed with Mike McLaughlin a long time prior to the early 90s.
I actually met Mark McLaughlin. He was when I ordered my first super modified chassis out there. Show Car Engineering, Howard Conkey owned that business.
Early '70s, yeah, mid '70s,
yeah. And Mike was actually welding there in the shop as a teenager and stuff.
Huh.
And I bought a second chassis off of him. And that the night we went out to pick up the second chassis, it wasn't ready to go, and I had to go back on Sunday. Ralph and I went out to get it. And so they were supposed to go to the Canandaigua banquet, and Mike says, I'll stay and finish it up so you guys can head out in the morning. And I've run across Mike. I mean, he still knows who I am.
That's cool dedication. Mobile shows up as a sponsor. How does that come about?
Like I say, director of maintenance for various trucking companies, and there happened to be like two out of the three of them that bought Mobile Oil Products, and their salesman was Bill Brooks. He was a gentleman out of Massachusetts. And so when the Coors thing disappeared, I says, Bill, how would I go about getting a sponsorship for my race car from that? And he says, well, I'll see if I can help you with that.
Mm.
And he did. He put that together. He put five Mobil Oil distributors in New England together with Mobil Oil, and it was a matching deal like Coors had been.
Yeah.
You know, what the distributor gave, Coors matched it. The tough part with them was they wanted so many appearances with them cars. I remember we did the World of Wheels. We did the Boston Truck Show, and we'd already started racing over to Monadnock and Claremont the year we had to do that. And so we're racing Saturday night, and the car's still in Boston, right? And Pete Rondo went, it was good enough to get down and get it out of there with his truck and bring it back. But
did he ever drive for you?
Pete never did. No, he used to pit right beside of us at Beechridge for years.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you never.
No, we were great friends. No, and boy, he's, you know, done very well in the world of auto racing.
Absolutely. So, you know, I brought up New Hampshire Motor Speedway, New Hampshire International back then. There's a picture of your car there with the Mobil One sponsorship. What was that like for you as a person who had so much skin in the game for decades to be at the show place of New England racing when that first came around?
If I'd have realized how important that was to go to New Hampshire and do well the first time you got there, I wouldn't have done it the way I did, because we had raced at Monadnock the night before, and then we go to New Hampshire and we're going to run that big show, and everybody's already been there for a day before we even get there, right? And the car had like 43 races on it that year. We'd been out to New York. We raced at Shangri-La once out to New York, 150 lapper out there. And so, you know, the motor wasn't top flight. That had a Bob Bruneau motor in it that I got a great deal on when Tom Bowles switched over from running modifieds to the Bushnoth series.
Mm-hmm.
His dad sold me that engine, and it was his Riverside Park. It was his shot track engine, so it fit. That was a 364. In fact, I still have it. I shouldn't have. I still have it in a trailer at Larry Tangway's. Yeah, my wife tells me that. You should have sold that about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I had that motor in the car. And so when they're checking the engine, you know, in tech, Bob Renault spied that it had his valve covers on it. And he says, "Where'd you get that engine?" I said, "Tom Ball's father." And he says, "Oh, well, there was three of them for sale." He says, "I knew..." He says, "Which one did you get?" And I says, "The Riverside Park engine stuff." He says, "You're wasting your time over here." He says, "That motor won't run with the restrictor plate on it."
Hmm.
And I says, "Oh, well, we bought the tires and everything, and David's all, he it's wants to home. Go out there, yeah. you know, he's, yeah, yeah. you know, and stuff." And he was right. I couldn't get that engine to run clean over there. And I had some people look at and told me what to run for jets and everything, you know, some guys I knew from Maine.
Yeah.
And so we didn't do well.
Right.
It just wouldn't run. It required more research. And then, you know, in retirement years, Andy, I live in a place in Florida. It's a community where Bob Garbarino happens to live there, you know, and I go to breakfast every week with Bob now and everything. And after finding out, you know, what it takes to run at that level, I wasn't at that level with my equipment. I was crazy to go. You know, I had good Saturday night stuff. It wasn't what they had. I mean, Bob had three hotter motors in rotation with him. And
Even to backtrack, actually not backtrack, but spring ahead to what it takes to run the, you know, the Whelen Modified Tour today. When they did that Daytona Battle at the Beach, where
yes.
they ran on the backstretch and they stove up a bunch of cars, and
I was there.
Oh yeah, that was an expensive race, and Bob was part of that one too.
He was, and he lost an engine down. They broke a crankshaft down there. I mean, there was so much thrashing. It was like just two drag strips, and they'd stop in the corners and run into each other whether they wanted to or not. And yeah, that was...
Yeah. Well, Mike Stefanik said it best.
Oh, boy, it was Mike mad when when he got turned. He'd led that race right till the final corner, and then he got spun out.
Yeah, welcome to modern-day NASCAR. So when do you hang up, not hang up the helmet because you weren't driving, but when do you decide to call it a day as a race team?
Because I couldn't take it any farther than we'd gone. We'd won the championship in 93 at Claremont. We went back in 94 and finished second. And I says, "David, I can't take you beyond this, you know."
Did he have aspirations to do touring?
Yeah, he would have really liked to run the modified tour. Mm. But I just knew, and I talked, of course, Sandy, you know, and I've been married for 56 years, and obviously we've talked stuff over, There was just no way at that stage. She says, "You know, if we're ever going to retire, you got to stop having the race cars." And she was absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have gone broke doing that.
She seems like if you didn't have her in your life, then your life would have been completely different than what it's turned out to be. What has she meant to you over your 56 years of marriage?
Everybody has troubles and financial troubles and all this, but for all the things we went through with the businesses and all this and that, and the ups and downs with the racing deal that everybody has, we always pulled in the same direction to get us out of those troubles. There was there was no question. What, you know, she's always stuck behind me.
What's your cheat code trade secret to 56 years of a happy marriage?
You got to both give a little, you know what I mean?
Hmm.
You know.
Not run the Whelen Modified Tour.
Definitely not. It just, for all the times I kept racing when I shouldn't have, that was, and I'll tell you the other person, I used to get my parts off Sonny Cazella when we started racing the asphalt modifieds, and I was down there getting parts one day, and I said, "Sonny, you know, geez, I'd like to move up and start running the tour and this and that." And he says, "Dave, are you happy with what you're doing?" I said, "Oh, yeah, we're having a good time." He says, And of course, he knew once in a while I didn't pay him for more than 30 days. I always paid him, but, you know, he always sent the parts, whether I was right up to date or not.
Well, he knew you were good for it.
Yeah. He knew I was good for it. And he says, Dave, you probably ought to just stay with what you're doing there, you know.
Had you hung on for longer, do you think you would have run Jack Bateman's Modified series?
I would have loved to have done that. I did help the Greeleys out a little bit there when David, for about 7 or 8 weeks, when the with the Greeleys, when they had that car and David drove it.
You still, you said you still love to watch Modified racing.
I love it.
Who sticks out to you these days? Who would you love to have in your car of the present day Modified drivers?
Wow. Wow, there's so many of the young guys. I can't pick one up.
All right, well, here's something a little more specific then. Is there someone out of the current crop of Modified drivers that reminds you of Ralph Cusack, that reminds you of David Pinkham, reminds you of Tom Oliver, the type of person you would want driving for you based on characteristics of their driving style?
Wow.
Like a Matt Hirschman.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. If he isn't a Ralph Cusack or something,
he kind of reminds me of him.
I don't know why I didn't just immediately think of him, because I was actually sitting in front of them at Concord Motorsports Park. His wife, well, his girlfriend and his mother were sitting right behind us. And he won the race there, and that was a tough place, you know. I don't know if you ever got there, Andy, but the racing was great there, a really fast half-mile D-shaped deal. And I turned around and I says, he just makes it look so easy. And I know it's not easy, but he makes it look so easy, you know. No, he would be it. There's no question.
Yeah, it's a good answer. I think that's a good way to leave it. David, it's been incredible to have you on the podcast. You know, we covered a ton of ground. I learned a lot, got to rehash a lot of cool stories, and appreciate you being a guest. Is there any parting thoughts on your end?
Well, I got to thank you. If we didn't have you, there wouldn't be any of this happening, and all the things that you did for Maine Vintage Race Car, it's incredible to keep that going. I hope there's as many young people come along that are interested enough to keep that alive.
They have a great group, you know. I was always going to be the guy that got them to the guy, and I'm glad to have had that time with them. But I mean, yeah, the Ken, who was in the position that I once held, doing an amazing job, and they're going in some different directions. And you know, we're all, much like you would say with you know, your wife Sandy, we're pulling in the same direction.
That's correct.
You know? So this podcast helps what they do and their awareness and the events that they do and the membership and all the things that is the big ship of Maine Vintage Race Car Association helps, you know, drive interest to this podcast. So we're all going for the same piece of real estate, you know. So I appreciate that compliment.
Well, you deserve any accolades that come your way. You do a great job, and I love listening to you as an announcer. You're so exciting.
Well, awesome. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for Dave, an extraordinary story. And I encourage you to go back and listen to the first two now that you've heard stage number three, and listen to them again in one swoop, whether you're on a drive or you're in the shop or whatever. Next time out, it's a driver who was lights out great in the early 80s of Beech Ridge Motor Speedway, another Hall of Famer, someone who's also in the Maine State Hall of Fame. We talk to Rick Zemla.
So this is strictly over the engine. This is before soaking tires and...
They did everything. When they say they're going to tear it down, they did everything. They checked the brake systems and everything on it. But they took parts of the motor apart so that they could see it.
And they never found anything, huh?
No, I never got disqualified because of it.
Who is doing your motors?
Ken Wood.
He's next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. See you next time out.